Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So have you heard the news? The average Canadian has more money than the average American. That's right. Nice little Canada. Okay, big Canada, with its single-payer health insurance system and its conservative banking rules, has surpassed the United States in average household wealth for the first time. What does it mean about our two countries and two cultures? We are delighted to have the chance to talk about this with the former Prime Minister of Canada, Paul Martin. He held the top job from 2003 to 2006. He was also very influential as finance minister from 1993 to 2002, when he focused on reducing Canada's debt, including through reforming social programs. Prime Minister Martin, so glad you would join us. Hello from New York.
Well, hello from Canada.
The average Canadian household owns $363,000 in assets, according to these figures, compared with $319,000 in the average U.S. household. That's liquid money plus real estate equity minus debt. Are you surprised that Canada, without as many Michael Bloombergs or Mitt Romneys, has taken that lead?
Not particularly. I think there are a number of reasons for it at this particular time. I mean, we did not suffer from a banking crisis the way that you did. We did not suffer from a collapsed housing bubble the way that you did, and obviously that's certainly affected household net worth. And at the same time, we eliminated our deficit. And we did this when times were good, although we've now got the deficit has come back because of the recession. But fundamentally, I think that we recognize that pro-cyclical economic policies by the government don't work. You should be counter-cyclical, and you should eliminate your deficits when times are good in order to have the room to maneuver when times are tough.
Why do you think Canada didn't have a banking crisis or a housing bubble that burst? We're seeing this all over Europe as well as the United States.
Well, first of all, our banks are better regulated than yours, and some may well say better managed. The fact is that, number one, we recognize that too big to fail really is a problem in the banking system when your banking system is so big that you cannot afford to let it fail, or in fact that taxpayers are going to have to pick up the slack. There's a huge lack of confidence. There's a huge lack of confidence and trust that occurs throughout the economy, because the banking system is, of course, the grease that makes the economy go. We did not allow our banks to merge. Equally importantly, at the same time that the United States, or actually New York and London, were competing as to see who was going to be the banking capital of the Western world, and they were weakening regulation as the means to do that, we actually strengthened. We strengthened both our capital requirements and our overall banking regulation, and obviously it paid off.
Listeners, we have the former Prime Minister of Canada, Paul Martin, on our program today. If you have anything to ask about Canada, this is your opportunity to ask someone who really knows. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, particularly things about Canada that are salient to problems here in the United States and whether there are lessons to be learned. But you can ask anything, 212-433-9692, or post your question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Mr. Prime Minister, as you may know, the news article that boosted this comparison of household wealth into prominent discussion was a Bloomberg News column the other day by Stephen March, which cited the comparative numbers and then went on to say, since the 1990s, Canada has pursued a hard-headed, even ruthless, fiscally conservative form of socialism. Its originator was Paul Martin, you. And then he went on to praise you for some of the things you just described, resisting deregulation, resisting the merger of the big banks and things like that. But what about that description of your policies as a fiscally conservative form of socialism, a hard-headed, even ruthless fiscally conservative form of socialism? That's going to strike many Americans as a series of oxymorons.
Well, I think that the word socialism is probably not is misplaced. The fact is that we were in considerable difficulty. We had the second highest deficit of the G7. We had a steadily increasing debt to GDP ratio in the middle 1990s. But the global economy was good at that point. And so we recognized that we had to move before there was a financial crisis, because if there was a financial crisis, our interest rates would have gone through the roof. And under those circumstances, of course, it's very hard for you to cut any kind of programs, and certainly including social programs. And so we moved. We didn't move, however, to eliminate those social programs. We didn't move because we wanted to cut them. We moved because we knew the only way we were going to protect them was, in fact, if we were able to get to basically turn around the law of compound interest, get into the, what's called the virtuous circle versus the vicious circle. It's a very important point to make. We moved in order to protect our social programs. The fact is that in Canada, I think, and I certainly believe this very strongly, we regard our social programs, strong social programs, as not as an obstacle to the working of the free market, but as a necessary foundation. In other words, if you're going to essentially deal with the rising inequality that comes out of the free market system, which I happen to believe in, you'd better have strong health care programs, strong education, strong social programs that are going to enable people to achieve, in fact, the same opportunities that others have. So when we cut those programs, we did it recognizing that we were going to reinvest in them when we eliminated the deficit. And when we did, 4 years later, have eliminated that deficit, which, as I say, was one of the highest in the Western world, we then immediately began to reinvest back into education, health care, and the environment, and all of those programs, which, in fact, nobody today can cut because of the difficulty, or nobody can support, except perhaps countries like Canada and the Scandinavian countries, because of the recession.
Susan in Washington Heights, you're on WNYC with former Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Mr. Martin. I'd like to know if there are any jobs in Canada for unemployed Americans like me.
Well, we certainly have as much of an open door immigration policy as we could possibly have. That is going to be a big problem for us. In fact, looking ahead, which is going to be a labor shortage. But look, we've got a continent, I think, that between us, and I think it's pretty important that both sides make it work.
And she shouldn't send her resume directly to you, I presume.
But we'd love to see you.
You mentioned immigration. There's an article by the conservative writer Raihan Salam on National Review Online that pushes back against some of the assumptions that liberal Americans might make about Canada and get too smug thereby by, you know, hearing about these stats and reading about your background. And one of the things he suggested is that Canada's immigration policy is partially responsible for passing the U.S. in household wealth, precisely, he says, because it's more focused on allowing in skilled immigrants, and it imposes a mandatory one-year prison sentence on immigrants who go to Canada illegally. Are both of those things true, would you say?
Well, there is talk of a one-year prison sentence. I certainly would not support that. The fact is that we do have, I think we have an enlightened immigration policy. I don't think we've brought in sufficient numbers of immigrants. And yes, there are points certainly awarded for skills and for language, but we also have a very good family reunification program. You got to recognize that if you're going to bring skilled people in here, they're going to want to bring their families in. And that you've got to be prepared to understand that that's a perfectly acceptable way for reasonable people to act. But there's no doubt that the importation of immigrants into this country and the importation of skilled immigrants has been a tremendous help to Canada, as it has been historically for all of us in North America, including the United States.
Indeed. Mary Ann in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi, Brian. I'd like to make a comment to Mr. Martin about how many incidents of gratuitous violence such as we've had do they have in Canada? I lived in Canada for 7 years on the East Coast and on the West Coast, and it always struck me when I came back into the United States how visible guns were, how, you know, walls had guards with guns, and it was the glorification of the military, which I found it was like I was looking at my country with new eyes, living in Canada, where they do their policing in a much less visible way.
Marianne, I'm going to leave it there for time, but she raises obviously a very central question on America's minds right now. Gun laws, gun culture, the kind of incident like we just saw in Aurora, Colorado. Does Canada have these two? You know, when we think about these kinds of incidents, some people suggest this is very U.S. Virginia Tech, Columbine, Aurora, Tucson, at the fringes, of course, but the fringe of U.S. culture in a certain way. Do you see it that way?
Well, we certainly do not have a gun culture to the extent that you do in the United States. But these are not issues, and in fact, even the economic issues that we've talked about that I believe Canadians can be smug about, we have had ourselves quite recently a number of terrible gun crimes. And one of the young ladies who was unfortunately killed in Denver, in fact, was at a gun crime where a shooter started shooting wildly at a shopping center in Canada about 2 weeks earlier. So, look, the problem is not the same as yours, but to say that we're immune from it would be just a mistake, unfortunately.
Do the guns used in crimes in Canada tend to come from the United States?
Oh, that's a huge problem. There's no doubt that the importation of guns from the United States is a problem. They're far more accessible in the United States than they are here. But sharing the same border with you, obviously that's a consequence that we have to live with.
Can you talk to our U.S. audience about single payer? Do Canadians just go to any doctor of their choice and the doctor submits the bill to the government and no money ever changes hands between patient and doctor?
By and large, what you said is true. And the other advantage, of course, of our single payer is that as a percentage of gross domestic product, our health care system is much less expensive than yours are, but on the other hand, we're more expensive than the Scandinavians. So yes, is the answer. Does that mean that we don't have problems? Do we have problems of access, waiting times? We do. But fundamentally, the single payer system works quite well. We've got a lot of very hard edges we've got to round off, however.
What keeps the costs down? The argument in the U.S. is, if the patient has no financial obligation to pay deductibles, copays, premiums, he or she will get too many unnecessary tests, too many unnecessary treatments, and break the bank. So is that a constant pressure in Canada?
Well, no, it isn't. Fundamentally, what we're saying is that if it's going to cost you and you're not going to be able to get to see a doctor, the fact is that's ultimately going to cost the economy an enormous amount. One of the great advantages that we have as well, and this goes right directly to the point that you're talking about, in the United States, whether it be MRIs or a lot of these issues, which are exaggerated substantially in the United States, because you've got these huge malpractice suits, this huge litigation against doctors, which I think costs you an enormous amount. Because in order to prevent those kind of malpractice suits, I think that people, my understanding is, I'm not a doctor, but my understanding is that people in the States go overboard. That is not a problem here. Look, our system works, but it would be a mistake to say that our system is perfect. It is not. And the same kinds of debates within Canada about the healthcare system occur here. Mm. Fact is that people do not go without healthcare because they don't have the funding.
What are some of the roughest edges? You used that phrase, rough edges, before.
Access. If there's an emergency, or if it's a, then obviously you'll get immediate access. But there are certainly cases where if what you need is medical care, but it's not an emergency and it can be put off, then sometimes you wait a little bit. You'll wait much longer than you might in the United States.
I had a former Bush administration health policy person on last week, and he said the problem with Canada is that 1% of health care delivered to Canadians is delivered in the United States. In other words, Canadian health care is good until you're really sick, and then those who can afford to come to the U.S. for the really good care for advanced diseases because the socialist system flattens the top in terms of quality. Do you accept that as true?
No, it is not true. Are there instances where people will go to the United States for health care? Of course there are. The fact is there are instances where people in the United States will go to India or Thailand for health care. In terms of expert health care, at the very top end, Canadian hospitals and the Canadian medical system is as good as anywhere in the world. That is not where the issue lies. The issue lies essentially if in non-emergency cases, can you get access as quickly as you would want?
The former Prime Minister of Canada, Paul Martin, is my special guest on WNYC right now on the news that for the first time, the average household wealth in Canada has surpassed that of the United States. And I guess, in a way, the biggest reason is not growth in wealth in Canada. It's that so much of U.S. wealth was tied up in people's home equity, and that has plummeted on average so much. Would you agree?
Well, we did not suffer from a collapsed housing bubble the way that the United States did with subprime, or in way we see Spain has as well. And this is because our banks, our residential finance sector, that is to say banks, mortgage brokers, fiscal incentives, in Canada are tied together in a way that mitigates against bubbles. Not perfectly. We did have bubbles. One of the reasons we don't have them, I don't think we had them recently, is that we had them in the 1980s, and I think we learned something from that. But it just goes back to the regulation of our financial system and then the way that it works.
Joseph in Middletown, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Mr. Prime Minister, I'm very happy to be able to talk to you. Canada is looked by a lot of liberal progressives as a model for many of the ways we can be better in our country. However, one area that seems to be Canada seems to drop the ball is on the oil from the tar sands. I see a lot of people complaining, saying that the oil exploration in Canada and then the delivery of that oil to the United States is an environmental disaster, and that the mining that goes on Canada is something, you know, akin to what you would expect to see in a third world. What are your opinions on oil exploration in Canada and how it's done environmentally, and is it environmentally as much of a disaster as it led to believe in on this channel?
I'm glad you asked that question. And there, of course, this relates to the Keystone Pipeline. Also, I think I saw in the news today that a Chinese company has bought one of the big Canadian companies that does this tar sands oil exploration. So what would you say about that whole thing?
Well, first of all, the expression is oil sands. And the fact is that there have been major environmental improvements, and there is extensive environmental monitoring of the oil sands. I believe that, obviously if the improvements that are being made there continue, that the oil sands will be able to stand with any other oil exploration or oil development on an equal basis. Again, are there issues that are there? Absolutely, there are.
So would it be accurate to characterize you as pro-Keystone?
Would be accurate to characterize me as Canada's oil industry and the development and the way it is. Like, absolutely. Whether it is Keystone or whether it's exports to Asia, those are issues which Canadians are going to have to discuss. And nobody denies that there are not environmental problems. There are environmental problems with fracking, which is taking place extensively in the United States. The issue is, how do you deal with them? And Canada has to demonstrate to Canadians, first of all, and then to the world, that we're going to deal with it in a responsible way. And I believe that we will do that.
Of course, it brings up global warming. And, people might think, when you hear predictions about global warming that are dire, people in Canada might be thinking, hey, that might not be so bad. We could use a couple of more degrees up here. Do people think that way in Canada?
Absolutely not. I would say there is a difference, I think, between perhaps the government's position and the position of Canadians on this. But Canadians are very strong environmentalists and have been from the beginning, and I think we are all very much aware that a substantial portion of our territory is in the high Arctic, and if there's any place that is suffering from climate change, it is what's happening in the high Arctic. So Canadians we have historically, in fact, been a leader in this area. We are not today, and I think that's most unfortunate.
So in our last minute or so, how much of the kinds of things in Canadian policy that we've been talking mostly about, regulation of the banks, avoiding the housing bubble that way, and single-payer health, could be used as a model for the United States?
Well, look, I don't want to be smug, and I don't think it makes any sense. But I think all of us, all countries, can learn from each other. The United States has been in many areas high tech, as an example, something that the rest of us could follow. I believe that the fundamental change is that we believe in the positive role of government. I believe very strongly in the free market. But anybody who believes in the free market has to recognize that the free market depends on the positive role of government in terms of social programs, in terms of reasonable regulation. I think we put it together pretty well. I think some of that in Canada is at the present time under challenge, and I think that's most unfortunate. But I think we can all learn from each other.
By the way, do Canadians get resentful about Americans calling ourselves Americans, since we're all Americans?
Well, we've given you to it. We're all North American.
The former Prime Minister of Canada and former Finance Minister of Canada from the Liberal Party there, Paul Martin, thank you so much. This has been very instructive for many of our U.S. listeners. I really, really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for calling.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.